When the American author Helen Stewart Campbell visited New York City around 1891, she got to witness firsthand Bellevue's new ambulance service respond to a call at 16th Street. She copied down the vivid details for her book, Darkness and Daylight, a fascinating firsthand perspective on the nation's leading city. When the ambulance arrived, there was apparently already a crowd of curious onlookers gathered around the victim, Patrick O'Rourke, a bricklayer, who had fallen headfirst out of his third-story window. The surgeon jumped out of the wagon and got straight to work. He examined the unconscious patient, who had landed in a crumpled heap on the sidewalk, and found a pool of blood quickly growing around Patrick O'Rourke's head, as well as a broken leg. The surgeon quickly grabbed a splint and some bandages out of the ambulance, put the patient on a stretcher, and loaded him into the wagon. The driver immediately set off back to Bellevue, while the surgeon filled out an ambulance patient slip in the back, which described the particulars of Patrick O'Rourke's case. When they arrived at the hospital, staff was ready for them as they carried the patient into the receiving room. The physician on duty took the patient's ambulance slip and carried Patrick O'Rourke into the ward on his stretcher, where the orderlies and nurses took over from there. The job of the ambulance surgeon was done here. Today, ambulances are a hallmark of urban life. You hear them practically everywhere, and in a city like New York, they are all around us. The modern ambulance that you know today originated in New York City 155 years ago. In hindsight, its purpose feels so obvious that its creation must have been inevitable. A service we may not even think about until we really need it. Let's say your child comes down with a bad case of pneumonia, your grandparent is having a stroke, or you hit a pothole on your bicycle and go over the handlebars. You know that no matter what, if you dial 911, a dispatcher will send an ambulance to you and it will arrive in a matter of minutes. But what if there was no ambulance? And what if you had no car and no money to flag down a cab? What could you do? In 1869, the ambulance was a new, revolutionary medical service. And the demands for its creation happened because specific factors came together at a particular moment in New York City's history. Historians look at the past this way, as contingent on multiple causes that shape where, how, and why events happen when they do, not as a series of events unrolling in predetermined storylines. Join me as we dig deeper into the why behind the ambulance. Why was the nation's first ambulance service invented at this specific moment in New York City? The backbone of this podcast are its historical sources: municipal reports, hospital ledgers, and newspaper articles. They are supported by the scholarly work of other historians, with an emphasis on the historians David Rosner, Ryan Corbett Bell, and David Oshinsky. I am also joined by three guest speakers, two medics, and an emergency medicine physician, who lend their contemporary viewpoints on the history of emergency medical work. I was curious to hear healthcare workers' perspectives on the state of emergency medicine today, but I also wanted to put them side by side with the stories of the first emergency healthcare workers from our history. Interlacing voices from the present with stories of the past can reveal a lot, not just about our history, but about our present moment too. It's almost eerie how our speakers' stories fit so neatly into accounts of the past. For instance, still today, low-income individuals seem to use the ambulance service more than any other social class. This is a story that may be as much about class tensions and the social experience of illness and injury as it is about the evolution of emergency medicine. Let's go back to the beginning. I'm Alyssa Moore. This is Responding to Crisis, the Origins of the Ambulance System in 19th Century New York. Part 1, The Ambulance. Our story starts in 1869. On June 4th of that year, the first ambulance service in the United States, two horse-drawn wagons out of New York's Bellevue Hospital, started taking calls. The ambulances of 1869 were pulled by 1 to 2 horses and could cover 1 mile in 5 to 8 minutes. Today, horse-pulled wagons may seem laughably slow, but in 19th century America, most urban speed ordinances permitted vehicles to travel only 3 to 6 miles per hour maximum. In contrast, the ambulances' galloping horses were quite the spectacle. and they quickly captured the public's imagination.
And that's kind of exactly it. Like, everybody wants a little drama, and we are kind of a spectacle with all of the flashing lights and the reflective tape and the siren and all of the things. Everybody wants to know what the heck is going on as you're going by. So it is intriguing. It's interesting to the general population that hopes that there's something exciting going on.
That was Kelly Shingledecker Larson, our first guest speaker.
My name is Kelly Shingledecker Larson. I was a paramedic for 22 years, and now I am an emergency department nurse.
In 1869, the first ambulance wagons were made of polished black wood and could fit a driver, a surgeon, and two patients lying down along with the equipment. Equipment included two stretchers, a stomach pump, handcuffs, and a straitjacket. Any additional items had to fit in the ambulance surgeon's small leather bag: a pocket surgical kit, a tourniquet, splints, gauze, bandages, antiseptic fluids to stop infection, and a flask of brandy, for the patient's pain, of course. To absorb the shock of traveling over the city's uneven cobblestone roads, the body of the carriage was rigged on suspensions high above the wheels, and the interior was padded with cloth. The sides of the ambulance were made of canvas and could be retracted to slide the patient into and out of the ambulance on a stretcher. Each wagon was outfitted with a gas lantern and reflectors for answering calls in the night. And before the advent of the modern-day siren, each featured a bell that the driver operated with a foot pedal. Ambulance surgeons, which were essentially 1860s paramedics, typically rode crossways on a bench along the back of the wagon, hanging on with a leather strap attached to the ceiling of the carriage. In total, the ambulance weighed about 600 pounds, and measured 7 feet long and a little over 3 feet wide, making it small and light enough to maneuver through New York's narrow and crowded streets. Like today, how to quickly summon an ambulance to a precise location in a large city was a pressing issue in 1869. Bellevue turned to the era's leading communication technology, the telegraph. Telegraph wires linked the ambulance directly to every police station dotted across New York City. When an officer was called to the site of a medical emergency, he ran to the nearest police station and wired a Morse code message to Bellevue. It contained the location of the emergency and a brief note describing the medical issue at hand. On the other end of the line, a gong sounded in the hospital's stables, which signaled to both the surgeon on duty and the driver of the new call. Thankfully, today communication has progressed beyond telegraphs and Morse code, with the invention of 911 in 1968. As our ambulance systems have gotten larger and more complex, so have their communication abilities.
In one of the larger dispatch centers, the person answering a 911 call is probably looking at between 8 and 10 computer screens. Some of them are maps, say like a map of the city, but then some of them are maps of where ambulances and police cars are, or what each of the ambulances is doing. So they can see every call that somebody is on, every street corner that somebody is sitting on. They kind of can control or orchestrate where ambulances go from there. As the paramedic calls in and says, I'm going to this hospital, they can say, that hospital is not equipped for that patient. We would like you to reconsider and go to this hospital. Or if for some reason somebody's CT scanner is down, this hospital, you can't take the stroke patient to this hospital. They don't have a CT scanner right now. We need you to go here.
Like communication technology, our equipment has changed a lot as well. Today, medics carry an incredible amount around with them.
So we carry a first in bag, and it's gotten significantly smaller. The first in bag used to be big enough to sit on. It weighed probably 35 pounds. It was not ergonomically easy to carry around. And now it's turned into like something you just carry in your hands. And we've really slimmed down what we need. But out of that bag, I can get a set of vitals. I can correct the blood sugar. I can do first line cardiac arrest medication. So there's mostly just the basics in there that we need, some simple bandaging, throw an IV in. But our equipment is so cumbersome, and we have great equipment, but it's heavy. Our stretchers now are 200 pounds because they're hydraulic. My cardiac monitor is almost 40 pounds. plus an oxygen tank, plus Lucas, which does CPR for us. So before we even get the patient on the stretcher and its gear is 300 pounds.
Vanessa Soldal-Jones is our second guest speaker and joins us by phone call.
My name is Vanessa Soldal-Jones. I have been a paramedic for about 27 years. I am a registered nurse in the emergency department. I've been a nurse since 2008.
Her colleague, Kelly, agrees that there is a lot that medics carry around with them on a daily basis.
We can work as a tiny little emergency department in the back of the ambulance. There is a huge list of medications that you carry plenty of, and then you throw in the critical care box, and that is everything else that the emergency department has. When you're in the back of the ambulance, it is bags and bags of medications, you know, little bags inside of bags. And there are so many of them, and you need to know how to use all of them and what they are all for. So you need to be a pharmacist. You need to be a cardiologist. You need to be a respiratory therapist. You need to be the emergency room doctor. You need to be a surgeon. There are so many things that, as a paramedic, you need to know.
Today, ambulances operate out of all kinds of organizations. There are voluntary ambulance services, private ones, hospital-based, and more. The first ambulances operated out of Bellevue, a public hospital, which stood in stark contrast to New York Hospital, the other large hospital in Lower Manhattan. Unlike Bellevue, New York Hospital was a private hospital and only accepted respectable patients. In other words, patients who could pay their medical bills, and preferably Protestant. Because they were based out of a public hospital, Bellevue's ambulance service did not get to pick the patients it treated, and its location in the middle of Lower Manhattan's poor immigrant communities meant that Bellevue saw an incredible variety of suffering. That's not to say Bellevue welcomed everyone with open arms. Jewish and Catholic patients were often treated with suspicion by Bellevue physicians, who were majority Protestant. Though its patient profile was working-class immigrants, the variety of cases Bellevue saw attracted the brightest doctors and researchers. Ironically, the most impoverished patients in the city were being treated by the nation's medical elite. Originally, Bellevue tried to hire these physicians for the job of the ambulance surgeon, but were quickly forced to abandon this plan. A meager $50 per month plus room and board could not entice established physicians to abandon their private practices or venture outside the safety of Bellevue's gates. Bellevue's administration decided that interns, equipped with only their medical school knowledge, would rotate onto the ambulance during the first phase of their appointment, a practice which continued for several decades. The schedule was brutal. Apart from one day off per month, surgeons were kept on 24-hour standby, each alternating 12-hour shifts on the ambulance. Even during their 12 hours off, a surgeon was still on call to be summoned day or night if the gong sounded while the on-duty surgeon was already out.
Just working 24 hours was, honestly, it was horrible. You would come home, you would sleep for most of the next day, and my kids were born while I was a medic, so they were kind of used to it growing up, that when mom leaves for work, mom leaves for work and she doesn't come home till tomorrow sometime. Just those long, long days, they can be horrible for everybody around you if you haven't had any sleep, or hopefully not as horrible for your patients.
Over the course of one 12-hour shift, an ambulance surgeon was exposed to a variety of calls of all degrees of severity. When you arrived at a scene, you could be confronted with any kind of illness or injury. Bellevue Hospital's admitting record books tell us that the early ambulance cases included a worker badly injured in a boiler explosion, an intoxicated woman who fell from a third-floor window, a malnourished Irish boy who was caught in the wheels of a streetcar, a German immigrant who attempted suicide with a butcher's knife, and victims of all kinds of disease. Despite the unbearable hours and difficult casework, staffing the ambulance gave interns a unique opportunity to see the reality in which their patients lived.
You know, working in the hospital, I will never see the inside of someone else's private life. I will see what they brought to the hospital, but I will not see how oddly fascinating or just downright weird people are in their own homes. And as a medic, you get to go out there and see all of these odd or fascinating things and people and places, you know, places that you would never be personally invited into. You get to meet people of any socioeconomic background. You know, the governor might get sick and you're going to meet the governor today, but a homeless person outside the governor's mansion might get sick and you're going to meet the homeless person that sleeps on the governor's lawn today instead of the governor.
As we hear from Vanessa, she agrees with her colleague.
It is really important to understand where they came from, to understand where they want to go and how to meet their needs. And all of that's missed when they self-report to the hospital. When they come to the hospital, they're removed from their environment. You lose so much information and an opportunity to actually help somebody for real.
Despite having just begun their Bellevue rotations, interns were essentially unsupervised on ambulance runs. They enjoyed an incredible degree of independence and liability as they operated out among the city's factories, tenement homes, and crowded streets on their own. They simply were handed their medical bags and expected to learn on the fly.
I can, honestly. I can imagine that, because that is kind of what it feels like. Sure, we operate under a physician's license, but really they're trusting that we know what we're talking about. That's a lot of trust, and that you're expected to really know what you're doing and be clearly independent with what you're doing. It takes kind of a special person. So I would think that if an intern is willing to jump in a vehicle or a horse-drawn carriage and, you know, it's like making a house call in that day, you know, so your intern, they've probably still got more education than what we're throwing paramedics out there in. So as much as I would like to say that this is shocking, it's not as shocking to me.
Armed with little hands-on experience, interns needed to quickly learn how to navigate the uncontrolled environment that lay outside of Bellevue's walls.
When you go into someone's house, it is a completely different situation. It can truly just be chaos. It always felt to me so much less stressful to have a person come into the emergency department than to have all of these variables that are outside that we have no control over. You have no control over what is in their house. You have no control over the other people in their house. You have no idea what's laying around waiting for you.
It was not long before a special camaraderie formed among the interns, fostered by the trials of riding the bus together. They even initiated macabre traditions to add a touch of lightness to their work. For example, an ambulance surgeon who came back with a patient who was DOA, or dead on arrival, had to buy a round of beer for all the other interns.
There is a good piece of disconnect. Like, you can kind of talk about it afterwards, and whether you talk about it or you joke about it, you know, we all have weird sense of humor. So you joke about things that are completely inappropriate to joke about. We discuss ripped off body parts at the supper table. You cope with things in different ways because you have so many things to cope with.
In its first week alone, Bellevue's ambulances were called by police telegraph 36 times. By the end of the first 6 months, the ambulances responded to a total of 558 calls. And in its first 18 months, only 4 patients died on the way to Bellevue. The ambulance was an overnight success, and its interns were never short of cases. The dangerous factories and rundown tenements of Lower Manhattan ensured there was a steady supply of working-class immigrants who suffered from all kinds of illness and injury. Part 2, Sanitary Conditions of the City. No document illustrates the dire living conditions of New York's working class quite like sanitary conditions of the city. Let's go back to 1865, just 4 years before the first ambulances started operating out of Bellevue. That year, New York City's Council of Hygiene and Public Health published one of the most influential public health studies in the United States, Sanitary Conditions of the City. A team of New York physicians went block by block through Manhattan's Lower East Side. It was a collection of the poorest neighborhoods in the city, and they documented the squalid conditions of its working-class residents. 9 of the physicians' notebooks survive at the New York Historical Society. When we take a look inside, we see that their findings were remarkable. On a typical block, a physician described,
"There are 20 tenement houses occupied by 111 families, 5 stables, a large soap and candle factory, and a tan yard. And in a dark and damp cellar, about 18 feet square by 7 feet high, lived a family of 7 persons. Within the past 2 years, 2 have died of typhus, 2 of smallpox, and 1 has been sent to the hospital."
Their appalling discoveries went on and on. Sanitary Conditions was a watershed moment in the city's history. Its horrid descriptions of the health of the city's poorest residents sparked calls for the creation of a revolutionary service known as the ambulance. These calls, though, came from an unlikely source. In fact, it was the city's wealthy philanthropic elites who demanded the ambulance service. But this makes little sense. Rich New Yorkers rarely went to hospitals for treatment. Hospitals were known to expose patients to countless illnesses. In 1865, there was a 50-50 chance that you might die from a post-operative infection at Bellevue Hospital. While the working classes used hospitals, rich New Yorkers simply called a doctor to their home. So, how can we explain this? What could a historian do? Historians use strategies called close reading and contextualization of primary sources to help better understand historical events. Reading Sanitary Conditions with a historian's perspective gets us to engage in critical thinking about the past. Sanitary Conditions can tell us a lot about society in 1869, and by reading in between and beyond its lines, we can begin to decipher why exactly wealthy New Yorkers subsidized an ambulance service they never planned to use. Let's start with the when and the where of Sanitary Conditions to better understand the why behind the creation of the ambulance. Sanitary Conditions was written at a time when New York was quickly becoming one of the fastest-growing industrial areas in the world. Technological innovations kick-started the era of mass production. An explosion of new labor opportunities attracted waves of immigrants from Europe. In just 20 years, from 1850 to 1870, Manhattan's population increased by 80%, from 515,000 to 942,000 people. By 1860, almost half the people living in Manhattan had not been born in the United States. This number only continued to grow as Irish, Germans, Russians, and Italians made their way across the Atlantic. While New York was certainly no stranger to immigration, never before did the city have to absorb newcomers on a scale of this magnitude. It felt as if a second city had sprung up overnight. The old city was Protestant, white, and wealthy. The new was a kaleidoscope of religions, ethnicities, and nationalities. Many of these new immigrants went to work in the factories, foundries, and warehouses springing up along the waterfronts of Lower Manhattan. Thanks to the railroad boom and new strides in steamship technology, companies like the Morgan Iron Works built huge foundries in New York. Its workers churned out everything from 30-ton steamship engines to the beams to support New York's new elevated subway. The 25,000 New Yorkers employed at these companies, many of them immigrants from Manhattan's Lower East Side, operated forges that reached temperatures of 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit without protective equipment. Serious burns, impalement injuries, and foot, finger, or hand amputations were common. New York also led the nation in garment production after Isaac M. Singer patented his industrial sewing machine in 1851. Before, a coat took 16 and a half hours to sew by hand. Now, with Singer's sewing machine, that same coat could be made in just 2.5 hours. Immigrant women worked as seamstresses 10 hours per day, 6 days per week in these garment factories. Operating the fast machines with no safety guards left them with severed fingers, mangled hands, or amputated limbs. In the long term, bending over a jarring sewing machine for hours on end led to crippling strain on their bodies.
You know, if you have a job in the 1800s, kind of a working class type of job, yeah, you're going to be more, you know, on your feet. You're going to be doing a lot of heavy labor, and there may be injuries that you are going to have that person working in an office, you know, is not going to encounter. Also, just that environment that they work in, you know, sometimes there's poor ventilation, they're exposed to fumes or chemicals or toxins, and that is going to lead to long-term cardiopulmonary disease. And just in, I guess, the labor in and of itself, because it's so hard and you're doing it for so many years, you may develop chronic musculoskeletal problems. And as I mentioned, you know, you may have a traumatic injury, and that could lead to like a long-term disability, depending on what it is.
This is Dr. Jeff Roberg, our third and final guest expert.
I'm Jeff Roberg, and I've been practicing emergency medicine for 19 years now.
The city's rapid industrialization, impressive though it was, outpaced desperately needed safety regulations. These may feel like issues that live far in the past of 1869, but as Dr. Roberg points out, we still deal with them today.
I mean, we still see our fair share of, you know, factory work-related injuries. It's obviously different now, like, because of OSHA. And we still see, you know, people that might be operating, you know, a machine press or operating a saw, and so it can have extremity injuries, crush injuries. I do see, and sometimes this happens with the immigrant population, I think that sometimes, especially certain like construction or roofing, you know, there's immigrants that tend to take on those jobs, and injuries from nail guns or sometimes a fall from a height. So I'm not always sure if the OSHA standards are being met. Some patients are not exactly trusting of the medical system, whether they're documented or undocumented. Sometimes patients, they're concerned. They feel like the medical system somehow would report them, which we would never do that, but they're hesitant. So they either delay, you know, seeking care, or they just avoid it altogether. Many times this population, they are uninsured or they're underinsured. Obviously, there's language barriers. You know, we do certainly the best we can to make sure that we have either a translator that's there in person, or, you know, a phone translator to try to help with that visit. It complicates matters because you're not always sure you're getting the correct translation. And so sometimes that can lead to kind of roundabout way to make your diagnosis. One of the challenges is trying to get this population, you know, to trust us that we are trying to do things in their best interest, and we're there to, you know, help them and take care of them.
By 1860, immigration and industrialization had made New York one of the most densely populated places in the world. The population of the Lower East Side alone was over 20 times more dense then than it is today. The city had also become a place of substantial wealth inequality. The bulk of the working class lived near their jobs in Lower Manhattan, where their neighborhoods were a haphazard mixture of overcrowded tenement homes among the city's grimy factories and crowded docks. Civic leaders mostly left these neighborhoods to fend for themselves. Garbage boxes filled with household waste were rarely emptied by the city, and their contents regularly spilled out onto the street, attracting all kinds of pests. According to the historian David Oshinsky, neighborhood slaughterhouses butchered more than 1 million animals every year. With nowhere to discard the carcasses, butchers simply let the blood run into the open sewers. Children could often be seen playing with the entrails of these animals that were left to rot in the city's gutters. Even worse, New York at this time was home to over 100,000 horses. In total, they deposited roughly 2.4 million pounds of manure and at least 300,000 quarts of urine every single day onto the city streets. Bathrooms were just a hole dug in the ground in the backyard of tenements. One alone could serve up to 100 people. Unsurprisingly, these bathrooms were prone to overflowing into the street, and sewage often found its way into nearby drinking wells. It was said that the stench of these neighborhoods was almost unbearable. With no street cleaning service, the filth sunk into the deep cracks of the cobblestones. In the winter, the sludge could freeze up to several feet deep. It should come as no surprise, then, that the 1800s saw several rounds of epidemics, like cholera, spread like wildfire throughout the neighborhoods of the working class.
Anytime you have contaminated drinking water, or sometimes it can be contaminated, food. So any area that would have poor sanitation, if you, lived in a crowded area in New York City in the 1800s, you probably would not have access to clean water and modern sewage systems. And, you throw your garbage, your waste out into the street, that is eventually end up in your drinking supply. It's a GI or gastrointestinal infection, going to have nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain. Sometimes you would have bloody diarrhea, and usually it's it's described as a very severe watery diarrhea. So we're not talking like one or two episodes of diarrhea a day. I mean, this is just, it's pouring out of you kind of thing. And it can cause rapid dehydration, a lot of electrolyte abnormalities, and if it's not treated, you can certainly die from this.
In addition to sanitation, overcrowding was also a major issue. Tenement houses originally built for one family were regularly occupied by up to a dozen. Step back and imagine what it must have been like for an entire family to essentially share a single room. Little air circulation and close quarters created the ideal environment for respiratory illnesses like tuberculosis to spread.
It's highly contagious, a spread by droplets. So, anytime you have a lot of people in a small space, and, you can just think about, even your personal experience, if someone in your family, or you have roommates or whatever, and someone has a respiratory illness, usually doesn't take long before everybody in that household is ill. I can imagine back in the 1800s, there'd be these neighborhoods where you would have, overcrowding, and sometimes you're going to have, multi-generational families, multiple families living in a close space in just one unit. If you are in a place where you don't have a lot of ventilation, somebody gets sick, everybody's going to end up getting sick most likely.
By 1869, poor living conditions and frequent on-the-job accidents meant the mortality rate of a working-class New Yorker was 5 times higher than a rich New Yorker. The city's mortality rate was so high that it surpassed nearly every other city in the nation. Working-class immigrant New Yorkers made up the majority of those injured or ill, but had no way of getting to a hospital. So did the wealthy take pity on their fellow New Yorkers? Did they agree to pay for an ambulance service out of the goodness of their hearts? It certainly was not long before elite New Yorkers started to take notice of the public health crisis engulfing the city. While certainly illness and accidents affected the rich and poor throughout New York's history, never before had it been this visible or this drastic of a spike. But while there was a sudden increase in the rate of disease at this time, it mainly affected working-class immigrants living and working in Lower Manhattan. With every day that passed, wealthy New Yorkers grew more and more frightened that the diseases associated with the poverty, overcrowding, and foreignness of new immigrants would spread northward from Lower Manhattan to the better neighborhoods of the city. More worrisome to New Yorkers was the connection between poverty and disease as a sign of moral decline. The report even named this condition tenant house rot. At this time, many believed that poor health was proof of an individual's mental decline, and held up disease as evidence that a community lacked strong morals and the long-cherished American values of hard work, cleanliness, and progress. Illness was now a social danger, not just a biological danger, to the city's elites. To back up this belief, the physicians behind sanitary conditions cited biological determinism, or the belief in a genetic link between disease and ethnicity, specific traits inherent in Irish Catholics, Italians, and Jewish immigrants in particular, allegedly predisposed them to a life of poor health. The Irish were routinely blamed for epidemics of cholera and typhus. Jewish people were allegedly responsible for tuberculosis. And Italians were later blamed for outbreaks of polio in New York City. As to their frequent workplace injuries, Foreigners were simply believed to be more vulnerable to the rigor of American life, to quote the historian David Oshinsky. This was in spite of the fact that immigrants quite literally powered the nation's industrializing economy in 1869. Regardless, the moral meanings assigned to disease and injury and their association with immigrants shaped the city's medical response to the public health crisis at hand. If this idea sounds absurd, consider how we think about disease and its relationship to stigmatized populations today.
Certainly immigrant populations, I think it would be more non-white immigrant populations are viewed a certain way, that they might carry certain diseases, whether it's tuberculosis, or some people, you know, think that everybody that comes from Africa or something would carry Ebola with them. I mean, you know, there's ridiculous things like that. So I see that, not so much, you know, immigrants coming from Europe as back in New York City, you know, in the 1800s. So we just have a different type of immigrant population, you know, people from South America or Mexico. I think that there's probably a view that they carry disease, you know, at a higher rate.
As more people moved into the city, native-born New Yorkers were beginning to find themselves outnumbered by immigrant communities who were vastly different from them. They belonged to different religions, ethnicities, and nationalities. They lived in poverty, and they seemed to always be plagued by poor health. It seemed like the image of a cohesive Protestant New York shattered almost overnight. New York's rapid changes were wildly spinning out of the control of the city's elites, and the spike in disease and injury stood in as symbols of the social disorder and upheaval happening all around them. Rich New Yorkers had reached a breaking point. Better medicine for the working class was a pragmatic solution to the situation at hand, not a humanitarian one. Even though their ethnicity may predispose them to a life of poor health, care at the onset of illness could at least stop the spread of working class diseases to New York's wealthier neighborhoods. Healthier individuals also meant individuals of better character and higher morals, who were capable of thriving in this American society and contributing their labor to the progress and prosperity of its economy. In the minds of New York's upper classes, medicine like the ambulance could be used as a method of social control. Influential society leaders quickly threw their weight behind the initiative of the ambulance. In fact, the first ambulances materialized just 2 short years after the publication of Sanitary Conditions. It was not long, though, after its 1869 invention, that the Bellevue Ambulance Service earned itself a reputation among all New Yorkers. Part 3. Free Advertising? The Orange Riot of 1870. The summers of 1870 and 1871 saw bloody clashes between Irish Protestants and Irish Catholics in the city. Known as the Elm Park Riots, the first took place on July 12, 1870, a little over 1 year after Bellevue's ambulances first went into service. At the strike of noon on July 12, approximately 2,000 Protestant Irish, known as Orangemen, having spent their morning at local bars, began processing up 8th Avenue. They were taking part in a long-standing annual parade to celebrate their victory over the Irish Catholics at the 1690 Battle of the Boyne in Ireland. Outfitted with banners and full regalia, they began taunting Irish Catholics with Protestant folk songs. A crowd of Irish Catholics quickly gathered. They began shouting threats as they followed the procession to nearby Elm Park, where the marchers were set to have a picnic with their families after the parade. By 2 o'clock, about 3,000 men, women, and children were gathered inside the park. What started with either side throwing stones quickly escalated into a chaos of shovels, crowbars, bullets, and makeshift clubs pulled from a downed wooden fence. In the 30 minutes in which the riot took place, 4 people were killed, either from gunshot wounds or skull fractures. Hundreds more were wounded, and many later died at Bellevue. In the midst of the chaos, though, a passerby might have been able to spot 2 polished black ambulances amongst the rioters. Their interns were quickly scooping up bloodied men and beaten bodies and whisking them off to Bellevue.
An ambulance, you know, service gets to the scene, they can kind of start separating these patients out. So what you have to do is, you know, you have to prioritize, and you know, a lot of it's based on their vital signs, and you separate them out, and people that are not real injured, they can definitely wait. Then there's people that are kind of in the middle, you know, going to need to be transported, but they can wait, or people that need really pretty immediate transport because they have a life-threatening injury that needs an intervention at a hospital quickly. And then there's other people, you know, on the other end that are basically what we call perimorbid. So they're dying and they're unlikely to survive their injuries. And so those people are not going to be transported immediately. You're going to transport the people that have the highest chance of survival. But the ambulance crews would help to start that triage process and, you know, then get the patients out and then to the hospital.
Inside the ambulances, interns were doing all they could to start life-saving medical care for their patients. And each wagon had a policeman inside to stop the patients from starting up the fight again on their way to the hospital.
There would be some interventions that they could start with just during the transport. One of the kind of basic stuff, some of the things never really change. You know, you're going to make sure the patient is immobilized. And then if they, you know, could use like a compressive dressing on any of the wounds that they would have. And if you had other things like other fractures, extremity injuries, or if you had a gunshot wound, again, putting a compressive dressing on or using a tourniquet above the site of the gunshot wound if it's an extremity, or they had a wound to their chest that you could put an occlusive dressing on that. Those would be the things that back then it would be better to have at least someone that had some sort of training. So there are still like basic things just like bleeding control. So just having a tourniquet, which they had that back then. You know, every medic now in the field, they have a tourniquet. I mean, that they still have those. And, you know, people die because they bleed to death. And if you can prevent that just from a simple intervention, that has not changed. So there are some things like that. They haven't changed. Splinting and things like that, just basic care hasn't really changed.
The riot brought to New Yorkers' attention, in dramatic and high-profile terms, just how necessary an ambulance service was when the community really needed it. Ironically, the riot served as a kind of macabre advertisement for the advantages of life-saving emergency aid. Bellevue's ambulances saw nearly 80% increase in call volume shortly after the July 12, 1870 riot. From 95 cases per month, they started seeing upwards of 170 cases per month on average. That fall, Bellevue even added 5 more ambulances to its fleet to keep up with the pace of the work. It was not long before other hospitals, both in New York and across the nation, followed suit and created their own ambulance services. By 1883, there were 19 ambulances operating out of 7 hospitals in New York City. Today, New York's emergency services respond to upwards of 11 million calls every year and is the largest emergency services system in the nation. Even though the nation's first ambulance started at the insistence of New York's elite, for the city's working-class immigrants, ambulances did bring relief and hope to their communities. Rather than manage a health emergency on your own, a life-saving service, quickly reachable and staffed by medical practitioners, was now readily available for you.
They trusted you to call you into their home and deal with this with them, and you don't want to lose that trust. Walking into somebody's house that has called 911, you have to understand their vulnerability. Something was so terribly wrong that they allowed you into their home and their space, and they trusted you in that time. It's still a very personal thing. It should be for both of you.
Before, you may have thought that the ambulance was preordained or unavoidable, or that its history was steeped in a sense of public good and charity. The reality is that political pressure from rich New Yorkers and anti-immigrant fear were actually its driving forces. Taking a close look at historical sources like sanitary conditions and their context helps us see that demands for the first ambulances happened when immigration and industrialization collided in a particular historical moment when the social makeup of New York was changing dramatically. In a very real way, these class tensions and anti-immigrant attitudes shaped the city's medical response to the public health crisis of 1869. It's important to reflect on how we frame disease and injury, both historically and now. There is, of course, the biology behind disease, but there is also the social experience of illness and injury. To us, 1869 attitudes may seem outdated, but you may be surprised to hear these stigmas have stuck around.
People would view people that, you know, just depending on their sexual preference, might have a sexually transmitted infection. You know, specifically, I think people would view those people as having HIV a lot of times. And then mental health patients, you know, anyone with mental illness are still looked, you know, down upon, and they feel that mental health is not like another disease process, you know, like diabetes or something. Anyone that is, you know, viewed as homeless, they, I think, would probably have a similar stigmatization, you know, to maybe the working class, that they're dirty, carry disease, and are drug addicts, that type of thing. You know, unfortunately, we still do see stigmatization of those populations. You know, it is interesting that, you know, things have obviously changed in terms of our technology, but, you know, in many ways, there are things that are unfortunately probably very similar. We still have a lot of, you know, underserved people in this country. That certainly hasn't changed. And it feels like sometimes we forget our history in this country. I think that it's important to remember that, because there's a lot of lessons learned.
In this podcast, you heard stories from our present intermingle with narratives of the past. Pulling together two different time periods, 155 years apart, has allowed us to weave between our history and now. But these stories also bring our attention to the future. So many public health problems from our history persist into the present. It can feel like the crises of today are unavoidable or insurmountable. Public violence, disease, and injury continue to occur as a result of unsafe housing, poor living conditions, or a dangerous disregard of workplace regulations, especially when it comes to working class communities and immigrant communities. To make matters worse, funding for emergency services continues to erode across the country. We may no longer be able to rely on the assurance that life-saving services like the ambulance will be there when we need them. In this sense, contingency is an important tool for thinking about history. If imagining a world without the ambulance sounds frightening, history, and its contingencies, reminds us that individuals can shape the course of future historical events. When we understand that history could have turned out differently, we see that our future is not predetermined either.
The technology is pretty stupendous right now for making some major advancements in interfacing with people's lives, injuries, and illnesses pre-hospital. We have money if they want to spend it that way, and we need the buy-in of the public to say, yeah, this is what we want. Most of the public doesn't ever think that they're going to need a paramedic. Like, why would I need that service? I'm fine. And I've never had an ambulance come and pick me up, but I'm willing to pay into the program for the betterment of the community. It helps our children on school bus crashes. It helps our elderly when they fall on the sidewalk in January on the ice. It helps everybody.
Perhaps it makes the most sense to close out with the words of Dr. Roberg.
I feel good about the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, where you came from, we're going to see you and we're going to do our best to take care of you. And it doesn't matter if you have money, you don't have money, you're insured, you don't have insurance. And that's why I say, you know, we're the emergency services in this country. We are the safety net for our country, our society. It's developed over time and it wasn't always, you know, necessarily like that. And sometimes it is, yeah, the place of last resort for people. So I think if you don't take care of people, eventually it's going to come back one way or another to affect the rest of the society.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by me, Alyssa Moore, with the help of the Archives and Public History Program at New York University. Thank you for the assistance of Dr. Ellen Noonan. Director of the Archives and Public History Program. Thank you to JoJo Carlin, Digital Scholarship Specialist at NYU Libraries Digital Scholarship Services. Thank you to NYU LaGuardia Student Technology Center and Computer Lab. Thank you to guest speakers Kelly Shingledecker-Larson, Vanessa Soldal-Jones, and Jeff Roberg. Thank you to voiceover artist John Moore. Thank you to consultant Kathy Crosius. For a complete list of the music and archival audio in this program, as well as a full bibliography and suggestions for further reading, please visit our website at nyu.manifoldapp.org.